John Feinstein is the number one New York Times bestselling author of the classic sports books Season on the Brink and A Good Walk Spoiled. His latest is the first major, the inside story of the 2016 Ryder Cup, a dramatic chronicle of the bitterly fought international golf tournament that pitted a U.S. team out for revenge against the Europeans determined to keep the cup out of American hands. Over the last 20 years, the Americans had lost a devastating 8 out of 10 competitions, but last year the U.S. team played brilliantly and came through with a remarkable win to the 2016 tournament. John Feinstein's new book is The First Major, the inside story of the 2016 Ryder Cup, and he joins us on the roundtable this morning. John, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Joe, it's good to talk to you again. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Obviously, you enjoy writing about golf. So what it seems like the planets really aligned in this case.
Well, they did, which was fortunate for me. But I've wanted to do a Ryder Cup book ever since my research for A Good Walk Spoiled, which you mentioned there in the introduction. I went to the Ryder Cup in 1993 at the Belfry, which is the last time the United States won overseas, and was struck right away by the intensity of it, the passion, the uniqueness of the whole setting because of the enthusiasm of the fans, the way the players behaved in ways that you would never see them behave at any other golf event, and really always wanted to get around to doing a Ryder Cup book. But it really all started to fall into place after the U.S. melted down at Medina in 2012, blowing a 10-6 lead on Sunday. And then the whole Tom Watson, Phil Mickelson takedown at Glen Eagles in 2014 when Watson, the captain, was feuding with Mickelson, his most experienced player. I knew after that Hazeltine was the time and the place to do the book because the Americans were going to be so desperate to win after all of their failures and all the controversy. And it would be uphill for the Europeans, but if they did somehow win, it would be a remarkable story too.
Just talk a little bit about the event itself, the Ryder Cup, because it's unusual and it makes for an interesting story in and of itself, just the way it's set up.
Yeah, you're right. And that's why I called the book The First Major, because technically it's not a major. The four majors are the Masters, the U.S. Open, the British Open, and the PGA Championship. But to me, the uniqueness of the event makes it at another level. Again, in terms of emotion, intensity, than the major championships. And the reason for that, there are several reasons for that. One is that it is a team event in an individual sport. Right. For 1 week, every 2 years, all these guys who are used to everything being only about them and their golf game have to come into a team room and share it with 11 other players and captains and caddies and wives and try to get along and try to do what's best for the team, not necessarily what's best for the individual, and that can be very difficult. Tiger Woods struggled with it. Phil Mickelson struggled with it, and that's one reason why Europe has dominated the event for so long. But also, you're playing for your country, or in the case of Europe, for your country and your continent. There is extra pressure in that. It's remarkable to talk to the players and have them describe the first tee in their first Ryder Cup. Padraig Harrington, excellent Ryder Cup player who will someday be a captain for Europe, said that he got over the ball on the first tee on Friday morning at his first Ryder Cup, and he stood there, and he stood there, and he stood there, and it occurred to him at some point, these people aren't leaving until I swing the club. I'm going to have to do it. And many other players have similar stories of terror. Keegan Bradley, who played great for the U.S. in 2012, said he almost tried to escape while on the putting green warming up. He walked over to Phil Mickelson, who he was partnering with, and said, I don't know if I can go through with this, Phil. And Mickelson said, no worries at all, Keegan. We're playing Rory McIlroy and Graham McDowell. They've never lost a match in foursomes, so there's no pressure on us. That's why, you know, there's nothing like the Ryder Cup.
So when you look at it, the fact that it is such a special tournament, what makes a great golf player a great Ryder Cup player?
Well, that's an interesting question because the greatest players aren't always the greatest Ryder Cuppers. You know, as I mentioned, Tiger Woods as a player had a losing record, 13-17-1 in the Ryder Cup, played on 7 American teams and 6 of them lost. Phil Mickelson, before Hazeltine, had been on 10 American teams and 8 of them lost. On the other hand, a guy like Colin Montgomery, who never won a major championship, never won a tournament in the U.S., is the all-time considered the all-time best Ryder Cup player, and that's why he's in the World Golf Hall of Fame, his Ryder Cup play. Ian Poulter, never won a major championship, great Ryder Cup player. And I think it has to do with being able to buy into the fact that the event is different, that you do have to be willing to sacrifice. Maybe you play, you partner with a player who's not your best friend. When Hal Sutton tried to get Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods to partner one another in 2004, knowing they didn't like each other, he felt like, hey, they're the two best players in the world. They should be able to get along for 36 holes of golf. Well, they didn't. They lost both their matches. But the Europeans, on the other hand, Poulter said that, you know, we have our differences too, just like the Americans. But for 1 week every 2 years, we put them outside the door and leave them there. And then when the week is over, we all think Colin Montgomery's a jerk again. But that's the kind of approach they took. Monty, is, by the way, never tried to say that wasn't true. In fact, he said that the reason he and Nick Faldo, another great Ryder Cup player, were always paired together was because nobody else wanted to play with him. And so they played with one another, and they were a superb team. So I think a lot of it has to do with the approach you take. If you take the approach, as the Americans did for many years, let's get through this week and do the best we can, you're probably going to lose. If you take the approach, hey, I can't wait to get there and participate and try to win, then you're probably going to win. And this American team, with a lot of younger players who did get along, Ricky Fowler and Jordan Spieth and Brooks Koepka and Matt Kuchar, a little older but highly respected by the other players, because they got along genuinely, not, you know, saying it in press conferences, they played much better golf.
So this isn't like a lottery. This is a team that is built. Talk a little bit about the building of this team.
Well, the way it works is on the American side. It's slightly different on the European side. On the American side, there is a point system that carries out over 2 years, from the end of one Ryder Cup to several weeks before the start of the next one. The top 8 players on that points list are automatically on the team. And then the captain, in this case it was Davis Love, picks the other 4 players. And that's where the importance of the captain comes into play, because it'd be very easy for him just to say, okay, I'll take 9, 10, 11, and 12 off the points list. But more often than not, that's not what he does. He says, who's going to fit into my team room best? Who can partner with a particular player who might be difficult to partner with, and pick them? For example, in 2012, even though Steve Stricker was a ways down the points list, Davis Love picked him because he was one of the few players who could partner comfortably with Tiger Woods. That happens a lot. Guys outside the top 12 often get picked because they're good guys in the team room. They have a lot of Ryder Cup experience. For example, Lee Westwood on Europe's side last year was way down the points list. But Darren Clark knew he had a team that was going to have 6 rookies on it, and Westwood had played in 8 Ryder Cups. He said, I need that experience on my team, so he took him over a number of guys who were well ahead of Westwood on the points list. So it's a combination of points and whatever the captain's gut feeling is about who he wants to add to the team.
When you look at where, and this is what makes the story so exciting, is that it didn't always seem like this was going to go well for the Americans. It is an up and down story. So at what point is, because you were there, at what point did you start to say, oh, okay, this could really work out pretty well for them?
Well, the honest answer is Sunday morning during the Rory McIlroy-Patrick Reed singles match, which is still as electric a sporting event I've ever been to. I walked with the match, and I've been to a lot of them, as you know, Joe, because I'm very old. But
very experienced.
You know, the U.S. got off to a great start. They were leading 4-0 on the first morning. I think it's fair to say they were inspired to try to win the Ryder Cup in Arnold Palmer's memory, because Arnold Palmer had passed away the Sunday night prior to the match's beginning. His golf bag from the 1975 Ryder Cup, when he was the U.S. captain, was on the first tee on Friday morning. And many of the Europeans were also close to Arnold Palmer, but Arnold Palmer was an American and had been a Ryder Cup captain for the U.S. And the U.S. got off to this great 4-0 start. It was the first 4-0 start for the U.S. since 1975, which was an interesting twist. But then Europe, as it always seemed to do, comes inching back, inching back, inching back. And Saturday afternoon, you look up and it's basically 6.5, 6.5. But then the U.S. finished strong Saturday and had a 3-point lead going into Sunday. But everybody remembered Medina. Everybody remembered the 10-6 U.S. lead that went away in a heartbeat. And Davis Love and Darren Clark both decided to put their best players out first. And that was a heavyweight match, Rory McIlroy versus Patrick Reed, each the clear leader of their teams that weekend. And McIlroy told me later that he knew that if he believed, if he could take Reed down, that Europe could rally again. And Reed said basically the same thing. He said, I had to win that match or we'd have all started remembering Medina. Well, I'm not sure I've ever seen better golf, certainly on the front nine. Think about this for a second, Joe. Rory McIlroy birdied the fifth hole, the sixth hole, the seventh hole, and the eighth hole, and he lost ground because Reed went eagle, birdie, birdie, birdie on those four holes. And when they both made long putts on eight, it was the loudest I've ever heard almost any venue, much less a golf match. And when Rory made his putt, Matt Kuchar was sitting in the American locker room because he was the 11th match out and wasn't on the golf course yet. And he said he thought that Rory McIlroy was going to rip his shirt off and go Hulk. I mean, it was that intense. And I was standing on the 11th tee a little while later, and McIlroy walked on the tee and he saw me and he walked over and he kind of grabbed my arm and he said, how cool is this? How great is this? He understood that he was part of something special. And Reed ended up winning that match one up on the 18th hole. And at that point, I was convinced the Americans were going to win.
You also write about this in the book, that the skirmishes that the American and European fans got into, which did, it affected the players, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, it did. And for the record, it was a distinct minority.
Yes.
I mean, there were 55,000 people on the ground Saturday and Sunday. And Jordan Spieth talked about the poorly behaved fans and called them one percenters. And as in 1% of the crowd. It might have been a little more than that, but it wasn't that much more. And I thought Rory McIlroy made a good point. He said, if you start serving beer at 7 in the morning, by 2 in the afternoon, some people are going to be in bad shape.
Yeah.
And he's right. And so maybe they should start serving beer a little later at future Ryder Cups. But look, the American fans were feeling pressure, much like the American players were, because it had been so long since the U.S. won a Ryder Cup. We'd only won once in this century. And as the matches got closer after the fast start the Americans had, you could feel the tension in the air. You could feel it ratcheting up. And, you know, there were fans, you know, screaming during the European backswings. And it got so bad at one point on Saturday that Jordan Spieth turned around and tried to quiet the crowd. Said, stop it. Just stop it. We don't want to win that way. And Henrik Stenson from the European team walked over to him and said, Jordan, it's okay. Don't let them bother you, because Jordan Spieth and some of the other American players too were feeling badly that their countrymen were behaving so poorly. And there was one really ugly moment that I happened to witness. Again, it involved Rory McIlroy. He was walking from the sixth green to the seventh tee on Saturday, not during his Sunday match. And he and his partner, Thomas Peters, were winning easily at that point in their match. And there was this one fan who was clearly drunk, and he was standing right up against the rope, and he was shouting, you know, things that hurt my ears, and I've heard just about everything, to the point where Rory finally turned around to his security guard and said, you got to take this guy out, which they did. And I asked Rory later, there were all sorts of fans yelling bad stuff at you all weekend. Why that guy? And he said, because I just happened to look him in the eye, because, you know, golf fans can get closer than fans in any other sport to the players. And he said, I looked him right in the eye at that moment. I really was nervous that if they didn't get him out of there, I might go over the ropes after him. And that would not have been good, Joe.
Let us end with the you read about this in the epilogue, but the celebration of the American players and how they look back on it now, of what how they feel that it fits into their individual careers.
Well, the cool thing about the Sunday night celebrations, regardless of who wins the Ryder Cup, is that the two teams almost always get together. the losing players will go to the winning team's team room in the hotel and drink a toast to the winners. Didn't happen in 2012 because the Americans were so devastated by their loss. But generally speaking, it always happens. And the Europeans went over, toasted the Americans, and sat around and drank with them. And Phil Mickelson and Darren Clark were sitting together telling stories. In 2006, when Darren Clark's wife passed away just before the Ryder Cup, he was supposed to walk in with Phil Mickelson and Amy Mickelson during the opening ceremony. It was player, wife, except that Darren Clark's wife wasn't there. So when the music started and the players were supposed to walk in, Amy Mickelson walked around her husband and took his hand and Darren Clark's hand and walked in with them that way. And 3 years later, when Amy Mickelson got breast cancer, the first call he got was from Darren Clark. And Davis Love talked about watching the two of them together and realizing that they were bonded in ways that went way past any golf match. And that's what the spirit of the Ryder Cup is supposed to be about. And all the players on both teams have those memories from Sunday night, the bonding that is part of the Ryder Cup, just about as much as the competition is part of the Ryder Cup.
John Feinstein's new book is The First Major, The Inside Story of the 2016 Ryder Cup. John, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks very much.
Joe, thanks for having me again.
Thank you. Be well. Again, the name of the new book is The First Major, The Inside Story of the 2016 Ryder Cup. It's published by Doubleday. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.